add up the pennies and the pounds will take care of themselves, my granny used to say. This year, consider giving Rabble.ca a few pennies. You can donate at rabble.ca/donate. You'll feel good and you'll feel even better when your name is entered in our prize draw. You could win an iPad. Rabble.ca/donate. It's a small price to pay to make a big difference.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
Years pass, memories fade, and history disappears. The present fills the gap with the illusion that today's events are uniquely fresh. So, for example, the Canadian government's current war on terror targeting Muslims at home and abroad could seem a new departure. And if you picked up a book subtitled Canada's First War on Terror, you might just think it refers to the present. But then you see the dates, 1918 to 1919, and that might sound puzzling. Well, Daniel Francis' latest book is titled Seeing Reds, The Red Scare of 1918-1919, Canada's First War on Terror. And to discuss the book, we invited Daniel Francis to the studio. Welcome back to Red Eye, Daniel.
Thanks very much.
Congratulations as well on your new book. I really appreciate the fact that you've brought this information, which is so relevant to today, back to light and in a very lively prose.
Well, thank you.
When did you start thinking about this book?
More than 20 years ago, I think, when I was living in Ottawa. I was doing some research on the history of the RCMP, and I discovered, I suppose I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was, that the modern RCMP, not the musical ride variety that we're familiar with, but the modern force, was actually created in 1919, following the First World War, and it was created principally to be a secret service agency to spy on left-wingers and labor leaders and so on. So it led me to wonder what actually was going on in the country at that time, the winter of 1918-19, that made the government think it needed a spy agency.
And did you start making notes and continue that for the 20 years, or did it drop off the edge with other projects?
No, that's more like it. There's always a long list of projects, and they migrate up and down the list. And I moved back out here to Vancouver, and it seemed to fall off the list for a while. And I always thought it was a wonderful, you know, you wait for somebody else to do it, somebody who you think knows more about it. And then eventually you say, well, I guess they're not going to. You have to do it yourself.
And were there contemporary events that provoked that diverting your attention back to this, or bringing your attention back to this?
Yes, certainly that's part of it. Since 9/11 and the war on terror that's being waged, and the same kind of demonizing of the other and so on that was taking place in 1918, I'm sure that was part of what led me to think the time was right. You know, historians always like to think that they're relevant to the modern day. They're not just dabbling in the dusty old past. And so I did feel that you could see echoes of the 1919 Red Scare in what we've been experiencing the last few years.
Now, we've mentioned the dates, 1918-1919, but what is the broader context of this period for the Red Scare?
I guess the context is, in a sense, the war, the World War One. We sort of are led to believe that World War One was a great unifying force for Canada, that we gained our identity at Vimy Ridge and so on. Whether that's true or not, it was also a highly divisive event. Divisive between French and English in the most obvious sense over the conscription issue, but also between labor and employers. The labor movement felt quite strongly that they were being asked to pay a great higher price to fight the war than employers were. And they demanded things like conscription of wealth, which was a popular slogan at the time. So there was great class divisions at the time. And then, of course, ethnic divisions in the country between recent immigrants, many of them for countries that Canada was now fighting, and native-born Canadians. And there was a lot of anti-immigrant bad feeling in Canada at the time. So the whole event was quite a divisive event, and And this is what was in the background of the Red Scare, I think.
And were there things beyond the Canadian boundaries that also made these events that happened that we'll discuss more in 1918 and 1919 seem so freighted with consequence?
Yeah, the world in general at the end of the war was a very unstable place. I mean, peace came in 1918, but you wouldn't know it if you looked around the world. There was a very, very violent revolution in Germany. There was, of course, the Russian Revolution in 1917, which was kind of the real background of many of these events that we're discussing. But closer to many Anglo-Canadians, there were violent general strikes in Britain, in the mother country. There was a civil war beginning in Ireland. There was a revolution in Hungary. There were slaughters in India. It seemed anywhere you looked, there was trouble. And then south of the border, they had their own Red Scare. And early in 1919, Seattle had a general strike, which prefigured in many ways the Winnipeg general strike. The American Red Scare was much more violent than ours. There was letter bombs and a much more extensive pattern of raids and arrests and so on. So that, in other words, everywhere the Canadians looked outside their own borders, they saw this kind of violence going on, and they thought, if there, why not here?
Now, the large Canadian capitalists saw these events happening. Were they, in terms of their response to them, both internally and in the context of the international events, were they quite unified in how they wanted to deal with suppressing these threats to their power? Or were there debates and divisions and differences within that class?
I think there were probably debates and divisions, as you suggest. Certainly there would have been the Colonel Blimps, who wanted everything to go back to where it had been before the war, that believed that employees should have no power or responsibilities whatsoever in running the industries, which is basically what the new, what many labor leaders wanted in Canada in the post-war period. But there were also many employers who were willing to accommodate to a certain degree this new quest for democracy, if you will, among their employees.
And what government did Canada have at that time during the war and in the immediate post-war period? What was its political composition?
It was called a union government. It was a combination of the Conservatives and the Liberals. The Prime Minister, Robert Borden, was a Conservative, and in order to get conscription passed through Parliament, he had invited some Liberals to join his own Conservative government and form this union government. So it was a combination of the two major parties.
And were they divided in terms of what response and what legislation and what actions to take in the immediate post-war period?
Yes, to a degree, they were divided as well. The Tory members of the cabinet were more aggressive in feeling that something had to be done about what they considered to be the Red threat. The Liberal members of the cabinet, by and large, were less aggressive. They didn't really oppose the measures that the government took very strongly, but they weren't as aggressive in arguing for them as the Conservative members of the government were. So there was a bit of a division in Ottawa.
You mention in your book that the Prime Minister, Robert Borden, was in Europe for a good period, lengthy period of time at the Versailles negotiations, and that the decisions and so on were being made by others in his party or in his cabinet.
Yes, that's right. It's actually kind of an astonishing thing to think of now that I forget now, I say in the book, how many days, months, and weeks that he was out of the country during that winter. But I think he went to England first in November and didn't come back to Canada for 6 months or something, you know. It's astonishing now to think in Canada that our Prime Minister would leave the country for 6 months and be abroad. And actually, of course, Borden naturally thought that he was at the center of things, settling the peace in Versailles, and his cabinet ministers would telegram him with their anxious thoughts about the revolution that was supposedly about to break out in Canada, and he would sort of poo-poo it and tell them just to handle things. He clearly, in his own mind, had more important things to be dealing with.
It is a strange in the modern world, I guess, with travel times being so much quicker, etc., and people always rushing to the home base. At the beginning of the war, a War Measures Act was passed. Was that contentious, and what were the dimensions of that act?
It certainly wasn't contentious. It passed, not in Parliament anyway, it passed through Parliament in a matter of hours, if not minutes. And this is the War Measures Act that we had, that was in place in the country until not so very long ago. I forget what year it was replaced, but certainly it was the same act that Prime Minister Trudeau used in October 1970 to handle an outbreak of so-called terrorism in Quebec. So it was with us for a long time, and it basically allowed it was very wide-ranging in its terms, but for the purposes of our subject, it basically allowed the government, the cabinet, to rule without requiring to consult Parliament, so that it could rule by order in council, as they would call it. It could basically pass laws without consulting Parliament.
So this is arbitrary power and rationalized by the fact that we're in an emergency because we're in a war and these kind of quick decisions need to be made?
That's right, although the powers, of course, extended beyond the end of the war, because when the act was passed, there was no terms under which it would end. It was more or less left up to the government. So it remained in place for several months after the war.
Now let's look in detail if it gave the cabinet the kind of arbitrary power to decree laws and actions of the government without parliamentary debate or discussion. What kinds of laws did they implement?
In the summer of 1918, as the war was sort of drawing to a close, but it was still in a critical period, there was a growing fear in the country about the possibility of a Bolshevik uprising. It seems almost absurd to look back and think of Canada, of all places, feeling that there was going to be a Bolshevik uprising, but this was widely spread fear, and the government did appoint a man named Charles Cahan, who was a lawyer from Montreal, to investigate how serious a threat it was, a kind of one-man royal commission. He reports back that indeed there is a great possibility of uprising, that the left is mobilizing, that money is coming in from Russia, raising all these different fears. So in response to Cahan's report in September of 1918, the September-October, the cabinet passes a series of orders in council, and among other things, these orders in council ban about, I think it's 14 political groups, many of them ethnic political groups, Russian, Ukrainian, Finnish groups, bans the use of foreign languages, enemy alien languages, as they were known by these groups, bans their publications. One order in council even banned strikes in the country until the war was over, but then not long after the war did end, and that order in council lapsed. So it was that kind of thing that the orders in council banned, and then almost immediately in October, November, using the powers granted them by the orders in council, the various police forces across the country went to work and raided a large number of political groups and labor unions, seized literature and so on, and made arrests.
You mention in the book that there was a censor in Canada, of some person. Could you elaborate how that position was created and what powers that individual was given?
Yeah, there was a chief censor, Ernest Chambers, who was appointed very near the beginning of war. You know, there was an issue over what Canadians should be allowed to know about the war and what was going on in Europe, information that it was feared would sort of sap the morale of people on the home front and lessen their enthusiasm for the war. So Ernest Chambers went about it with great enthusiasm. Basically, he and his small army of employees in Ottawa basically controlled everything that Canadians could listen to, see, hear, including movies, publications of various kinds during the war. But his powers went on after the war as well, and he was a key figure in the Red Scare. He was one of the strongest Red Scare mongers. He believed certainly he had a great fear of that a revolution was going to come in Canada, and he went out of his way to gather information and then to spread it to magazine publishers, newspaper publishers. He tried to enlist university presidents. I found letters in files in which he wrote to university professors asking him to give speeches against the Reds and so on.
Speaking of the newspapers and radio, which were the two main forms of media at that time, what role did they play in creating this scapegoating, this fear of the Reds, of the terror, etc.?
Yeah, they by and large, the newspapers and magazines jumped on board the Red Scare. There was one exception I found, the Toronto Star, a very interesting exception, that took a much more cautious approach to the scare, kind of downplayed the fear of revolution in the country. Certainly at the end of the scare, when in the spring of 1919, when the Winnipeg General Strike breaks out, they're almost the only newspaper in the country reporting sympathetically to the strikers and claiming that the idea that this was a revolution was just nonsense. But with the exception of the Toronto Star, big papers like the Globe and Mail in Toronto, the Montreal Star in Montreal, papers in Ottawa, papers out west in Winnipeg and Vancouver, very much climbed aboard the Red Scare. And by this I mean they published scare articles about what was going on in Russia at the time, horrific articles about cannibalism in the streets of Russia and that kind of thing, and the same thing could happen here. And then published articles describing a revolutionary activity in Canada and advocating in many cases that the government take a very strong stand against it.
What was the image of the Bolshevik at that time, the communist, in the media?
When I investigated this, I found it very reminiscent. I'm old enough to be a member of the 60s generation, and it was very reminiscent of the image of the hippies in the press in the 1960s. Dirty, irresponsible, believed in free love. These were some of the images of the Bolshevik. Of course, on the more dangerous side, they held dangerous ideas about the socialization of property, socialization of the family. There was a great deal of concern about the integrity of the family and the morality of marriage and so on, and a fear that these Bolshevik revolutionaries wanted to tear down the institution of the family. And of course, a belief in violence. Basically, these were just sort of brigands, not political thinkers at all.
I notice you reproduce a number of cartoons from the newspapers, and they're all bearded, dirty, filthy, sort of dangerous creatures you wouldn't want to get too close to.
Yes, I found one cartoonist in particular in the Montreal Star who had a wonderful series of cartoons, and I reproduced some of them in the book. But that's right, that's the image there. Drunken, filthy, irresponsible. That was the Bolshevik.
You mentioned the constant in the context, the question of the ethnic antagonisms and the seeing the more recent immigrants as the great danger. And the Winnipeg General Strike was kind of the climax of the labor struggles and also of the repression of the Red Scare. Were the people targeted in the Winnipeg General Strike sort of reaffirmed the notion of these more recent immigrants from Eastern Europe in particular being at the heart of the disruption of Canadian society? Or was that sort of stereotyping and antagonism really just fell to pieces at that moment?
Yes, it's one of the paradoxes of the scare that the real people to fear in the country were these foreigners, the enemy aliens with their alien ideas trying to impose them on Canada. And yet every time it seemed that the authorities arrested one of these so-called Reds, he turned out either to be native-born or a Brit, a recent immigrant from Britain. And certainly in the Winnipeg general strike, when that was broken with the arrests of the 10 main leaders, these were all native-born or recent immigrants from Britain. The authorities there went out of their way to try and implicate enemy aliens by arresting four other recent immigrants and charging them, but nothing much came of those cases. It's by and large the people who were targeted turned out to be either homegrown or recent immigrants from Britain. So it sort of contradicted this view, but still the argument was used, well, these were just the leaders, but they're preying on the ignorant masses, who recent arrivals from Europe.
Well, one last player in this scene, we have veterans returning from the war, the soldiers. They were involved in the events around the Winnipeg General Strike. Were they pro-business? Were they pro-worker? What role did they play?
Yeah, many veterans were involved in events all through that winter. There was a great deal of violence in the streets in Canada at that time. Resentment against the foreigner kind of boiling to the surface. There were street riots in Winnipeg in January aimed against so-called enemy aliens who were supposedly holding down jobs that the returned veterans couldn't have. There was violence in the streets of Toronto with a similar idea. Mobs of people, many of them returned veterans, invading cafes and stores owned by people who are identified as enemy alien, people being beaten up in their stores, smashed, and so on. So there was a great deal of this resentment, much of it belonging to the returned veterans. But on the other side of it, there were many returned veterans who were sympathetic to the new ideas, the new left-wing ideas. And in the Winnipeg strike in particular, I would think the numbers break somewhere down the middle. There were street marches by veterans who supported the strike and much activity by veterans who didn't.
Well, it's a book that has a great contemporary relevance, and I really thank you again for your contribution to the history and also to joining us for this lively discussion.
Well, thanks, Mordecai. I've enjoyed it.
I've been speaking with Daniel Francis. He's author of the new book, Seeing Reds, The Red Scare of 1918-1919, Canada's First War on Terror, and is published by Arsenal Pulp Press. You can find it at independent bookstores like People's Co-op Bookstore on Commercial Avenue and Spartacus Books on Hastings. And Dan Francis also will be speaking at a forum this Thursday on the policy of state repression in Canada, past, present, and future. Along with him, Michael Vaughan, policy director of the BC Civil Liberties Association, will speak. There will be comments as well by Brian Campbell, co-chair of the Seriously Free Speech Committee, and the panel is going to be introduced and chaired by Kimball Cario, who is the editor of the People's Voice. As I said, the forum is Thursday, January 20th, 7:30 p.m. It will be held at Simon Fraser University Harbour Centre campus, room 1800. And if you want a copy of Daniel's book, which I highly recommend, it will be available there too for sale.